Hey guys, it's Steve Baker, the Pragmatic Constitutionalist. Hey, a couple of months since I've done a podcast. I've been traveling a lot, been on the road, been chasing stories, and I decided not to take my gear with me on that particular trip, but I'm back in the saddle again, and I'm excited to finally bring to you today here on this podcast, former Capitol Police Lieutenant Tarik Johnson, otherwise known as TK. And the reason why I'm excited is obviously most of you know that I have been working with him for several months now in his story. We've been presenting his story to the world. And that includes a lot of whistleblowing in the process about what was going on at the Capitol on January 6th and in the days leading up within the police department itself. And in those stories, we have revealed a lot about why they believe Tarik himself, as well as other Capitol Police officers, believe that they were set up to fail that day. And that's the continued and ongoing exploration in much of our investigative work as we move forward. So I'm excited to bring that, and that's coming up here in just a moment. So before we start, just a couple of those little things to get out of the way. There is no soaps, potions, or lotions to sell here. I don't have any sponsors for this podcast. We are supported 100% and totally by those of you who follow us on our Locals platform, Locals Community, and that is very easy to get to. You can go to thepragmaticconstitutionalist.locals.com, or you can just type in TPC for USA. .com. It'll take you right there. Or on your device app, you can also find us at TPC for USA. It's free to subscribe on Locals, but for as little as $5 per month, you can help us do what we're doing, and we do need that help. It's expensive to make all of this come to light, quite frankly. And this is a moment, as I said before, that I cannot believe that I've taken so long to get to you, and that is this podcast introducing to you, with me for the first time, Lieutenant Tarik TK Johnson. Hope you enjoy.
Mr. Tarik TK Johnson, it is so good to finally get you on my own podcast. Welcome, man.
Well, first of all, I'm ashamed of you, because you should have had me on this show like 6 or 7 months ago. We've been friends and doing this stuff together for about the last 7 months. I should have been on your show, Steve.
Yeah, I know that, but you've been busy. I've been busy. And to be honest with you, I think that probably the timing is right now better than ever before. And keying off of something that you just said there, this is going to be a very different interview, I think, than any of the ones that you've done already. I mean, my goodness, you've already been on Tucker Carlson. You've been with Mike Howell from the Heritage Foundation. I just listened to your podcast with Daniel Horowitz over at Conservative Review. And that was great, by the way. That was one of the most concise, eloquent, and factual presentations that I've heard you do so far. I thought it was fantastic. So I encourage everybody to find that on wherever you get your podcasts. I listened on Apple. And then in addition to that, I must say that, yes, while I am supposed to be a dispassionate or a journalist who is not controlled by relationships or friendships or that sort of thing, I will tell you that over the months that we have been doing this together, in terms of talking and doing interviews, background, telling the stories about the Capitol Police and your own stories, we have become friends. And so just being upfront with our viewers and listeners that's the case here. So, you know, hey, we might get into some laughs. We might shed some tears. We don't know where this is going for sure. But I do want to make sure that we cover some ground that we haven't, or I haven't heard you cover on some other interviews yet. And so to that end, what I'm going to do is I'm going to be sure and post all relevant links wherever this video is posted. Obviously, it's going to be on Rumble primarily. It'll be on Twitter. It'll be on Facebook and other social media platforms. So I will post relevant links so that people can get the bigger story, the fuller story, and can go and listen to and see and hear and read more about this story that you have that you're bringing forth from January 6th as a lieutenant with the Capitol Police Department. And then, so if they felt like that they didn't hear everything they wanted to hear about a particular topic, they can still find it and still get it. So that, with that said, that is on the table. All right. Now, I want to start off by, you know, I want to just hit you right over the head with one thing right quick. Mm-hmm. You said something on Daniel Horowitz's podcast, and this is an exact quote from you. You said, "We are all J6ers because we were all set up." Now, the floor is yours to tell me why you believe that we were all set up.
Well, that's the first time I've actually said that on, you know, publicly. I've been thinking it for probably the last 2 years. I just was hoping that when things came out, people could connect the dots on their own. And it seemed like the dots weren't being connected. So I said, let me just tell you what I think. And that was Daniel from my point of view. And yes, I do believe that we were all set up and we are all J6ers. We were put into that situation by one commander. And because of what occurred on January 6th, it was bad in the sense that fighting each other, when we needed to look up to see the person that put us in that crock pot pressure cooker, put the lid on and basically closed it. And she's keeping it on us. And when I say we are all J6s together, we have to push that lid off to get out.
And that one person is?
I think today is actually her last day, but let's go with Assistant Chief Yogananda Pittman of the Capitol Police.
So as I said before, you've done some pretty high profile interviews already. So I don't want to spend a lot of time on those details. But before we dive into, you know, the most recent revelation that you brought to the table, I do want to cover maybe a little bit of just, we'll do the lightning round on your story. Again, I don't want to get into it. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this conversation in covering, you know, the rescue with the Oath Keepers, the red MAGA hat situation. Oh, and by the way, I'm wearing the cap that I wore on January 6th when I was at the Capitol. So,
well, if I wore the one that I wore, people would probably have issues with that.
Yes, that they probably, well,
some people would, some people wouldn't.
They already did have issues. We know that because, you know, the reality is you became international news literally that day. And especially the next day, you began to hit newspapers all over the world. And that was the story of you wearing the red MAGA hat, then recruiting a couple of Oath Keepers to help assist and pulling those 16 officers that were, they said themselves, because as you know, I've seen the transcripts, I've heard the radio transmissions, and I know that they called in, and the exact comments that they made over the Capitol Police radio comms were that this is a officer safety issue. They were concerned when they called that in, and you responded to that. You began the process of actually trying to coordinate other officers to help you. You were looking for a megaphone. There were all kinds of things related to this. You even called into command and found out that there were FBI and ATF tactical units available and that they were going to try and send those to you. Then you never heard a response about that. And then when that all happened, and as I said, this is going to be the lightning round, when finally, you realized you were getting no assistance and no reports back or no direction from command, then you took matters into your own hands and you did what?
Well, if you're talking about inside of the Capitol, the first thing I did was when I asked for direction, it was shortly after the Capitol had been breached. I had it was almost surreal to me. And I was thinking after I heard the first breach that occurred on the Senate side, I believe it was on first floor Senate door. And when I heard that, I ran into the building, ran over to the House side first, and then just to make sure those doors were locked on the House floor. Then I did the exact same thing on the Senate side to make sure those doors were locked. So after I did that, I was thinking, and I went over the air and I was speaking to Yogananda Pittman because she was the only high ranking command that I heard on the radio that would have been in the command center. So I asked, well, I said something to the effect, the Capitol has been breached. We have hundreds of demonstrators in the building. What do you want us to do? We need some direction. And I got nothing. So a short time after that, I went over the radio again and I said something to the effect, we have to start thinking about getting the people out of here before we don't have a chance to, people meaning members of Congress and staff. I didn't get a response. Shortly after that, I went over the radio and I say something to the effect that I have a clear line of sight from the Senate floor to the Senate door. I need permission to evacuate. And I waited for a response. I got nothing. The dispatcher had requested a couple times, no response. I said, I'll take the discipline. I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway. And that was at approximately 1428. That's 228. Approximately 8 minutes later, I did the same thing for the house, but I didn't even ask for permission for the house because I knew that she wasn't going to help. So that was approximately at 236. And then the house evacuation was initiated.
And then after that happened, then you moved outside. And then that's when you were overhearing right approximately at 3 o'clock or just before 3 o'clock, you were hearing the distress calls from these officers that were inside the Rotunda area. And that's when you responded there. So tell me the real quick, brief overview of what took place at that time.
So when I got outside, now I didn't know that the East Front was compromised to that effect. So when I went out there, I saw a whole bunch of people out there. I was like, wow. And I believe it was the Senate door, and I walked over to the middle of the plaza, which would have been the Rotunda stairs. And I look up and I see a whole bunch of people on the stairs. So I go over the radio and I try to see if the people who requested help, if they could walk down on their own. So I didn't have to make a trip up and a trip back. So they said that wasn't a situation. They couldn't make it down. They were gassed, something to that effect. So I went over the air and asked for a megaphone. I think it was a civilian HMRT guy, brought me over a megaphone. And I had a few CDU officers. And then we walked up the stairs and I was yelling certain things over the air on my megaphone. I said things like, I love Donald Trump. He's great. I voted for him. I loved him. We all love Donald Trump. So I can get through the crowd to get to my guys. So I got to the guys, told them to follow me out. I turned back around and I pretty much said the same phrases on the way out. But on the way out, a guy stuck a mega hat on my head. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got the mega hat. But right. By the time I got down the steps, I realized the officers that I tried to retrieve were not with me. So on my second attempt was when I used the two Oath Keepers, and we were able to successfully get up and get back down with the officers.
And in that particular instance, that was filmed, and that's where there was a videographer there, an actual filmmaker. Starza, is it? Do I remember that correctly?
His name was Rico LaStarza. I think it is.
Yep. Oh, yeah. And he captured that moment when you actually asked the two Oath Keepers or you were talking about the situation, and one of them literally said, oh, we're Oath Keepers. We can help.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them showed you his ID as being a law enforcement officer himself. And then when that took place, you handed the megaphone to, is that Mike Nichols that you handed the megaphone to? And,
yes.
And then when they walked up to the bottom of the steps, one of them got in front of you, put your hands on each other's shoulders. One of them was behind you, and he began to broadcast over the megaphone, clear the way. And it got you up to the top of the stairs. This time they got you successfully inside the building to where those 16 officers were. And then the short version, of course, is you were able to lead them down and get those guys out of the building. So that's the abbreviated background of all of this. So what I want to do now is I want to set the stage for the latest revelation that you just brought forth. And as you know, obviously, you know, and those who have read the article now know that myself and Joe Hanneman from the Epic Times collaborated on this story. We interviewed you. We interviewed former chief Stephen Sund. We made other interviews with quite a few other characters involved in this particular situation that we're going to talk about. And then I do want to start this by saying that the first time you and I met, I was sitting in a conference room at a hotel in Arlington, Virginia, when you came in. At that very moment, I had my computer screen open. I was listening to I was listening to the radio comms from that day, and I was working on the transcripts because the transcripts were inaccurate. The transcript that I had at that time was the one that had been given by the Department of Justice to the attorneys that were defending the Oath Keepers. And this transcript was a mess. I mean, it was an absolute mess. It was inaccurate. There were deletions. There were not redactions. There were just whole sections that didn't even exist. So as I'm listening to the radio comms and I'm looking at this transcript, I was having to basically go back through and do a new transcript. And that's what I was working on. So that was what you saw me doing when we first met. Then we went to dinner. And one of the first things that I told you at dinner that night is I said, Tarek, I wrote in my first couple of stories all the way back in January and February of 2021, in just the weeks following January 6th, that I said I considered the Capitol Police to be sacrificial pawns that day. And you leaned across that table, you stuck your finger right in my face, and you said, that's exactly right. They didn't give a shit what happened to us. Now, with that set up, tell me about this new revelation that you gave to Joe and I about the riot helmets that were confiscated from several dozen officers just in the days prior to January 6th. Go ahead and start that out, and I'll prod you as we go.
Okay, so basically, I get an email from my captain, Captain Benjamin Smith, and the email says that it was a list of officers who I had to have returned to me their helmets. So I forwarded email to my sergeant. So I had them start to collect the helmets, and the helmets were to be returned to me. So officers started bringing me their helmets. They were leaving helmets on my desk. There was no mechanism for me to track those helmets. There was no mechanism for me to give a receipt for those helmets, because I've never had to do that before. I don't work in the property division. So I don't record and give receipts to officers after they turn in equipment.
Before you go on, let's give everybody some really specific details about that, because there were actual protocol violations that you were commanded basically to violate. I'll just start with that by saying that not just with the Capitol Police, but basically every other police force in the world, including all of our military services, they have a protocol and what basically is called a one-for-one exchange. When a piece of gear, whether it's expired, whether it's there's new technologies for this particular piece of equipment, or whether it's damaged or whatever, when they take it to the property management division, and you guys have an actual building for that, correct?
We do.
And so what's supposed to happen is that in the event of an expired or damaged helmet, that you're supposed to take it to the property management building there. You're supposed to hand it in. You get a receipt for the return of your equipment. And then in return, you get a replacement item for the piece of gear that you're supposed to have, right? Do I have that?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
All right. So with that groundwork laid, tell me why, with you being such an experienced officer, that you didn't, or did you, question that order and the process by which they asked you to take up those helmets?
I thought about it. It was an unusual request, but unless the order is immoral or unethical and it was given to me by my captain, I'm going to follow it. There was no concern to me as far as the demonstration that was going to be occurring the following week, because we didn't get any intel that it was going to be anything more like what we've normally been doing when it came to the MAGA rally. So I just didn't think that it was going to be a situation where they would have even needed those helmets. So there was nothing that lit off a red flag to me. I just said, okay. And I took the helmets. I did what I was told. I got a couple of follow-up emails wanting to know the status. I replied back to to those emails, and I did what I was told.
Were those emails from Captain Ben Smith?
Yes, they would have been from him.
And that's who you got the order from?
That's correct.
Have you been able to determine at this point who he received his direction from?
You know what? It may have even been on the top of the email chain, but I wouldn't even have thought to even look to see who that order came from. He told me to do it. I did what I was told. So either he would have got direction to do that from our inspector, and I'm guessing that somebody from the property management division would have directed somebody to do that. But no, I don't know who the person was that directed Ben Smith to do it.
But that brings up another interesting point, because you may not have been aware of it. We know this now at the time, that the Capitol Police had received a significant amount of funding, hundreds of thousands of dollars for replacement of a number of helmets. I don't know how many that represents. I don't know how much each of those helmets cost, but there were apparently at that time about 104 replacement helmets on a pallet in the property management building. And it's just bizarre to me, or it's certainly a mystery to me, why they would have, why they didn't order you to have your guys, your officers take those helmets and exchange them at the time, when we now know that the replacements were there.
That's the question. Typically, you know, if they have a new helmet that they're going to give us for the officer, for the one-for-one exchange, mm-hmm. what typically happens is that property management will normally assign one of their employees over to the Capitol. Maybe they would assign one over to the Senate division, library division, house division, and they would pretty much do the exchange over there. So, you know, you don't have 1,000 officers walking over, you know, to the property management division. It's easier, and you don't have to worry about transportation to get there. So that's typically what we do.
All right. Tell me, did any of the COVID protocols or things that you were going through at that time related to the people that were on administrative leave and how many extra days off people? I mean, I know you had administrative leave days off during this time as well. And you guys were running on I would say a skeleton crew at the time, because the Capitol was not open to visitors at that time. Did any of that come into play as to why you thought that, hey, I should just go ahead and take these helmets?
No, that wouldn't affect somebody from property management bringing over the new helmets to give the one for one. Yeah. And it wouldn't have been enough time, even like at the time that they asked us, it would have been pretty much almost impossible to do the one for one. They would have had to start earlier to get that, you know, basically to get that done, because you got to take measurements, you know, you got to, you know, do fittings. Sometimes, you know, one size, you know, if you get one helmet, it could have been a medium, but the next helmet that you get is a medium, but it's a different company. So you're going to have to do, it's going to take more time, more than twice, maybe three or four times, if you add the time up just to retrieve a helmet than to retrieve it and issue a new one out.
Gotcha.
So the COVID protocols wouldn't have been anything that I would have been concerned about, because you would have just had somebody come from the property manager division over to the Capitol. So no.
Now, in the process of doing this with the helmets, there was something else that should have also been taking place at the time, because now we know that there was, in fact, quite a bit of intelligence that was being passed from the FBI and other agencies to the Capitol Police related to the event that was coming. Now, not only was there the big Trump rally at the Ellipse, which was actually not scheduled till December 9th or 19th. It was scheduled on December 19th, rather. That's when he announced that. But before that, there were actually already permits before that date that had been issued by Capitol Police leadership themselves for additional protests, rallies, stages, speeches, including two marches that were going to be marching around the Capitol that day. Those permits were already known, but at this point, when the helmet confiscation order was given to you, did you know any of these other events were taking place?
No.
See, this is a real bugaboo with me, and it's been a real major part of my investigation through this process. And you know, look, apart from you, frankly, maybe Joe Hanneman, I may be the person, at least among a very, very small handful of people who know the details of what was happening around this particular aspect of Capitol Police operation in the days leading up to and on January 6th. And part of that that really sticks in my craw and motivates me to get to the bottom of this is, why were the command level officers like yourself not aware of what was coming? This, to me, is the single biggest issue about that day.
When you look at the entire scope of the event, there was an intel report. It was is entitled 21 TD-159. That report pretty much laid out what was going to happen and what we were going to be facing on January the 6th. I know for a fact one commander had it, maybe two, but I know for a fact that one commander had that intel report. That was Assistant Chief Yogananda Pittman. And she did not pass that information out to the people who needed it the most. She never gave the report to Stephen's son. And I've spoken to Stephen's son, and he said that he never received that report. The other person, and it would probably be even more important for him to get the report, would be former assistant chief Chad Thomas. I haven't seen or heard from him since I was told he was fired 2021. I don't know what month it was, but it was maybe in the middle of 2021. I believe it was before Manger got there. But apparently he was fired. And this is what I was told about his situation, that he drove into work one day. Now, I don't know if you know this, but all inspectors and above, they get take-home vehicles. So he was driving in a take-home vehicle. So when he pulled up to the office, and this was after Pittman had already assumed command after Stephen's son resigned. So I heard that she had people waiting for him when he pulled up, and they took his ID, took his car keys, and drove him back home, basically firing him. And now I've tried to reach out to him like indirectly, but he's not talking. As far as I'm concerned, he's not talking to anybody. I believe he's under an NDA. Now, Chief Thomas's his job, he was in charge of operations. So it would have been his responsibility to make sure, that the Capitol was ready for the officers were ready for that day. But he can't do that if he doesn't have the information. So we don't know if he actually had the information. Now, Yogananda Pittman did say she gave it to him, but nobody has. To my knowledge, I haven't seen any interviews. I haven't seen any reports where he said, yes, she gave me the intel report, because that would mean that he got the intel report from her and he did nothing with it. I'm hearing that he did not get the report. Now, there was a deputy chief. He's retired now. That would be Jeffrey Pickett. He wrote a 16-page whistleblower letter, and I would encourage all of your listeners to read that 16-page whistleblower letter. He's saying that none of the deputy chiefs, to include Assistant Chief Chad Thomas or Stephen's son, received that 21 TD-159 report. Did they get it or did they not get it? That's the question. Chad Thomas would have had to make sure that his people were ready to go, and we can't find him. And if he's under an NDA, he can't speak about the event.
We've learned through corroborative interviews and testimonies. And when I say testimonies, I mean testimonies under oath, as a matter of fact, through Capitol Police officers that were testifying in, for instance, the first Oath Keepers trial, that they themselves, when asked under cross-examination, did they know what was coming that day? Did they know that there were events scheduled, planned, and permitted on the Capitol grounds that day? Did they know that there was going to be large numbers of protesters? Did they know that there were going to be actual Congress members scheduled to speak on stages on the Capitol ground outside that day? And without exception, they answered no. In fact, I recall one particular officer. His name is Ryan Salke. And Ryan Salke is the guy on the east side who stood his post when everybody else abandoned him and ran away. And the, let's just call them for now, the provocateurs, the agitators, those guys at the front of the line at the East Columbus doors were just hammering him with chemical spray. He was getting sprayed from all sides. He was getting punched, shoved, beat up, and he stood his post and he took all of that. And by the way, he had no helmet on. All he had was a stocking cap. He had no helmet. And this particular officer, Ryan Salke, in the Oath Keepers trial, he was asked, were you aware of anything happening at the Capitol or anything scheduled at the Capitol that day? He said, no. He said that in his morning roll call briefing, the only thing that he was aware of was, and this is a quote, was that something was happening at the White House. This is an officer assigned to protect the building, and he knew nothing about what was scheduled that day. Now, before you respond to that, I want to also include a statement that I have from he's an unnamed, but as yet whistleblower, because he hasn't come forward. He is a member of one of your CDU platoons with the Capitol Police. And when I asked him that question, basically, this is what he said. He said during their roll call briefing, that they were told that they would not be receiving a handout that day because it was too sensitive. And they all looked at each other and I'm just telling you what he told me. And they said, oh, well, this is interesting. And then when the captain gave them the roll call briefing, they all then looked at each other again and said, what the hell was that? And it was like, this is just another day at the office for us. It was no big deal. Then a few months ago, the Capitol Police released what they called their morning briefing for the civil disturbance units. He had never seen it. I sent him a copy of the briefing. Then he passed it around to some of the other officers in his own platoon. They all corroborated that none of them had ever seen that briefing. And in fact, they believed that briefing was a CYA briefing that was produced after January 6th, even though it's dated January 3rd. But they claimed that they never saw it and that it does not represent what they were told that morning. Take it from there.
Doesn't surprise me at all. It's what people call covering their tracks. That's basically what they did. In my opinion, there's really no excuse for that. You failed. You know, whether it was a purposeful failure or it was an accidental failure, you failed. So, and now you're trying to cover your tracks. That's what that was.
Yeah, we always try to lean towards government agencies by saying that their failures are due to incompetence. It's just the nature of a oversized government. The left-hand office often doesn't know what the right hand is doing. And through the process of investigating this entire process leading up to and on January 6th, I see far too many incidences of incompetence to allow me personally to accept that this wasn't an accidental failure, but indeed it was a failure that may have been planned.
And basically, that's what I said. I'm doing my last interview that I did earlier today. And when it comes to the helmets, and I'm just going to just say what I believe. I was a commander on that day, and I had no faith in my leadership after that day. And when I say leadership, I'm talking about one specific commander. I don't believe what occurred on January 6th was an insurrection. I believe it was a coup. And I said this already today, staged and led by an overly ambitious, misguided commander. So now, and when I say that, and let me explain why I say that, because now I believe that she had that report. There's no way you can read that report, 21 TD-159, if somebody gets it, if it's online. I have it, but I wouldn't want to read from it, because even though it was almost 3 years ago, it was still law enforcement sensitive, and I just don't feel comfortable reading it until somebody says, TK, you can go ahead and read it, because I would love to read it on the air. But
it is a public document.
I don't know if it's a public document because I couldn't find it online.
Okay.
So I have it, but I couldn't find it. You can't read that document. And see, now when she had to testify, she said that had I disseminated that information, our posture wouldn't have changed. She had no choice but to say that, because if she says anything else, that means she failed. Right. So that means that the posture would have changed, even though it would, because that was her saying that. Nobody, none of the other commanders said that. You would have to ask Chief Sun, if you had 21 TD-159, would you have changed your posture? I feel comfortable and confident that he would say yes. If you would have asked J.J. Pickett, if you would ask Tim Bowen, if you would ask Sean Gallagher, if they were in charge of operations and they had that report, I believe there is no commander that would have read that report other than Yogananda Pittman and said that they wouldn't change their posture based upon that. Now, let's go a little bit further. That report basically says that what was going to happen at the Capitol. Now, this is my opinion, because I know people are going to look at it and say, oh, that's slander. I'm telling you what I think, you know, and I do believe this is a form of free speech. So I want to say what I think. This has been one of those situations where we're trying to connect the dots. And I'm going to tell you the dots that I connected. So I don't believe that she believed that the Capitol was going to be taken over. I don't think anybody believed that it was actually going to be breached on that day. I do believe that from the intel report she had, she did know that there was going to be violence against officers that day. That would have been, for the most part, or all of it would have been outside. If there were a lot of officers being hurt, that would put into a situation where you could fire Chief Sun for that or have him resign, and then she could take over. And that's what I think it was. Basically, it was a coup staged and led by her to have Sun removed. I don't know if you know this, but Yogananda Pittman is connected heavily with the Democratic Party and some of the leadership there. So it would have also tremendously embarrassed Donald Trump and made him look even worse in people's eyes. So another run for president probably wouldn't be successful. And even just to make the Republican Party look terrible anyway, because you had a bunch of Republican Trump supporters attacking the Capitol and they hurt police officers. So now I'm not going to say that she did this, but if you want Chief Sun gone and you want the maximum punch for that day, you're not going to get Chief Sun fired if there's some arrests, a couple of officers get a couple of scratches. You need officers hurt as bad as they can be hurt. So what would you do to ensure that they are hurt badly? You would take their helmets right before the attack. That's what you would do. Right before the January 6th, you would take their helmets so you can increase the probability of officers being hurt. You need the maximum number of officers hurt to make a nationwide impression that Chief Sun was a failure and he had to go and he had to be replaced by Yogananda Pittman. And you had to make the current president basically put him in a position where he could never run again.
Now, one of the things that I appreciate and respect most about the interviews that I've heard you do so far, TK, is that when you're asked questions that you don't know the answer to, you don't bullshit. You say, I don't know the answer to that question, or I'm not prepared to answer that question. And you even refuse sometimes, I'm not in a position right now where I can answer that question. Whereas other people would just roll with it. And I will tell you that, and again, this is because we're friends now, is that when you first started doing interviews, both myself and Joe were really nervous. We had been developing a relationship with you for weeks and months, and we know how passionate you are about this. We also know how outspoken you wanted to be, and we just didn't know where it was going to go at that point. But then after you started doing these interviews, I'm like going, okay, he's okay. He's all right. He knows how to handle himself. He knows when to pull back. He knows when to say, I don't know. That's a big thing. A lot of people don't do that. A lot of people like to baffle people with their bullshit. There's an old saying that if you can't dazzle them with your brilliance, baffle them with your bullshit. And you don't do that. Okay. Having said that and laid that groundwork, now I'm going to ask you if you're willing to speculate on another aspect of this Yogananda Pittman thing of knowing what she knew, when she knew it, that sort of thing, because in my own stories, and this is based on what I saw with my own eyes, was I believed that as the day developed, I totally agree with you, that they did not know the extent of what was coming. They knew what the potential was, but then as each breach took place, they allowed it to go to another level. And it was almost like to me, that when the first barricade was breached on the outer perimeter at 12:52, and that was when Officer Carolyn Edwards was the first officer injured. She was shoved down. She hit her head on a concrete step, and then everybody raced forward to the next level. It was like, okay, the people in the command center are seeing this in the CCTV cameras. We know that. And it was like, all right, they didn't use any guns. They didn't pull any firearms. Mm-hmm. Let's see what happens next. And then they breached the next little line, which was that little black fence. It was like a little aluminum fence. And they started pulling that up and pushing that over. And then they came up to the next level of the lower terrace. And that's when they brought out the bike rack barricades and they put those out there. And it seemed like to me that it was not a coordinated thing, but it was a thing that was allowed to happen. And as each stage of this was taking place, and they realized that, okay, they're not pulling firearms, not pulling weapons, let's let them through again. That's kind of the way I saw it. That's the way I felt it. Even to the point when they finally breached that northwest door on the Senate side of the building, or they went through the window, rather. The two before went through the window. Pozzola knocked in the window with a shield. They started coming through. They opened that door from the inside. It was almost like, to me, the reason why you weren't getting any responses was because Pittman didn't want to be on the record either direction. She didn't want to be on the record as giving command failures or command directions that would work. It seemed to me that she was allowing each stage of this to happen as it developed.
I would say that's unlikely. And let me explain why it's unlikely. Yogananda Pittman, I've been there a long time, and I can tell you that I've been on incident scenes with Thomas Lloyd, Chad Thomas. We had, I can name them, but, you know, but I've been on incidents with Waldo. I can keep going on with most of those commanders. I've never been on the scene of an emergency situation with Yogananda Pittman. Mm-hmm. I have never seen her evacuate a building. I never seen her doing a mass arrest when you're arresting, you know, a massive amount of people. I've never seen, you know, and during those times we do citation release. I've never seen her do anything when it comes to operations in an emergency. So I would say basically when she was sitting up in the command center, yeah, now she might know what to do on a test because she kept getting promoted. But like a real life scenario, she didn't know what to do. So now I believe that the reason why she gave the command she did is just because she didn't know what to do. She might have done something like, oh crap, this is way worse than I thought it was going to be. Page one says, lock down the Capitol. Lock down the Capitol complex. Then insert to the house floor for the shooting. She didn't know what to do. So that was the case of Yogananda Pittman. And as it relates to what was going on the ground, when you say things were allowed to happen, no, because the officers would have had to been, they would have had to have some knowledge what was going on. They had no knowledge of what was going on. They had no idea what we were going to be facing. They just did the best that they could to try to stop it.
So that's what it was. Are you vacillating then between her incompetence or her willful withholding of knowledge, or how do you reconcile those two issues?
It would be both. Now she withheld she is questioned, and I believe she will be questioned at some point, and hopefully he's alive somewhere. Chad Thomas, if somebody has an eye on Chad Thomas, he's the key to this. He's one of the keys to figuring out if he had that intel. If Chad Thomas never had that intel, like she was supposed to give to him, then that means she sat on it.
We're talking about just so everybody knows, the other assistant chief.
Yes. The other assistant chief, Chad Thomas. If he never had that intel report, it came from her shop. So he couldn't have gotten it any other way other than from her. So if she never gave it to him, he had no shot in the game. So now this is where I'm going with my opinion. And I normally, whenever I get my interviews, if you listen to them, I stay with the facts. And I don't really try to say what I think. But I have no choice because it's been almost 3 years and nobody's putting together these dots. So I got to go ahead and say it. I believe that she believed that if she held that intel report, that Chad Thomas would not be able to prepare the troops for what they were going to face that day. And then it was going to be violence and officers would get hurt outside. Maybe 20 or 30 officers would get hurt really quick. We would be able to quell the situation and then that'll be it. It would have never been a situation where she would have needed to implement the incident command system. Mm-hmm. So now she was absolutely the person that was supposed to implement the incident command system because she had a bird's eye view of everything. She could see everything. She could see if we were being flanked from the left or the right. It was absolutely her that was supposed to do it. You can't ask Waldo to do it. You can't ask Lloyd to do it because technically, yeah, but they were in the middle of the fight, you know? So they weren't really in a position to do anything. They can't see if 50 or 60 officers coming from the right. Yogananda Pittman was right in the command center. She could see everything. So she has to.
Yeah, and everyone should understand that there's 1,700 plus cameras around the entire Capitol complex. So we're talking about not just inside the building, not just in the sensitive areas and the tunnels, that sort of thing, but there's the entire perimeter of that campus is surveilled by these cameras. So they had access in the command center to see everything as it developed. They saw the crowds coming up earlier in the day, way before Trump even, you know, began his speech at the Ellipse. They could see the crowds coming up. They could see what was happening, not just then on the west side. They could see what was happening on the east side, every side, as a matter of fact. And they could see the development of all of these things. They saw every breach. They saw how the violent protesters were breaching the lines. They saw to what level and to what extent that they were assaulting the officers. They knew that they were using sticks, flagpoles, clubs, bear spray, such as that, improvised devices like tearing that one fence apart into small pieces and throwing it as spears and clubs, all of those things. They could see all of this. And when that was all taking place, you were actually running around. This is another part of your story. In the early part of this melee, you were actually trying to find and to organize decontamination locations and tents actually set up, and having large quantities of water delivered because of the spray, you know, the OC spray and the bear spray, the pepper spray that the officers were being hit with. And so you were trying to organize all of that. And that was before the breach. But when the breach happened, were you already in the building at that point?
I think I may have been in the area of the Lower West Terrace, maybe right inside the door. And then from there, I took off because I didn't want to leave the West Front. But when I heard that the breach had occurred and people were in the building, that became the priority now. So I had to go make sure that the senators and congressmen were locked in there, their respective chambers, and what to do to mitigate this threat. That was what I was thinking.
And so obviously, because of either location or priority, I don't know technically why you chose to execute the evacuation of the Senate first, as we've already said, and you've clearly made known in many interviews and articles, that process was simply you asking for permission, giving directions of what you had in terms of getting them out, never hearing from Pittman, saying that you were going to take the disciplinary report for just going ahead and doing it on your own if you had to. You did that, you executed, you got the Senate out, then you went over to the House, you got the House out, and then the big moment happens. Because of the delays in getting permission, because you had to wait for that permission, there was a situation set up where Officer Michael Byrd was still in a hallway in the Speaker's lobby area on the House side when protesters, including Ashley Babbitt, arrived in that hallway. By your statements in multiple interviews, you have said that had Pittman just responded to your first request to evacuate the Senate 8 minutes earlier, that Byrd would have already been gone because he was the trailing officer to follow them down in the evacuation route. Do I have that correct?
100% correct.
Okay. So if you had received that permission from her and didn't feel like you had to wait, which I'm sure you felt like you needed to, that's a big decision. I mean, that's a big decision for Lieutenant Tarik Johnson to evacuate the Senate of the United States of America. You know, 100 plus of the most important people in the world, literally. And so you waited that 8 minutes before you executed on your own recognizance. And then fast forward, the House is evacuated. And then Ashley Babbitt arrives. We know the scene that happened there. We've seen it from multiple video angles. And your statements are very, very succinctly is that had she responded, Byrd would have already been gone. And essentially, Ashley Babbitt would be alive today. Do I have that right?
With no questioning at all, she would have been alive today.
So this is where, and again, I know you'll tell me what you can and can't say. But you have been a friend with Lieutenant Michael Byrd for years, correct?
I've known him the entire 23 years I've been there. Yes,
the entire 23 years. Wow.
Yes.
Who joined the force first, him or you?
Oh, he's older than I am. He joined first.
Okay. All right. So you've known him the entire time. So you have, whether it's a close friendship, at least there's a obviously 23 year working relationship. That's, you know, pretty significant for anybody in anybody's lives. Can you give me an opinion at all of your knowledge from your experience as an officer, particularly as a Capitol Police officer, particularly at the same rank as Michael Byrd, of what he was faced with in that moment and why he chose to take that shot?
Lieutenant Michael Byrd, in that particular situation, if he was listening, him and I still talk to him occasionally, you know, and we don't really talk about, you know, that he doesn't really want to talk about that, you know, but just sure, from if you go back, if he listened to the radio transmissions, you know, and obviously if you were there that day and you were listening to the radio, you could not turn it off. If you had the radio on from 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock, you're not taking your ears off that radio. And all he had to do was hit a button to listen, like switch a button to listen to my radio transmissions. And he needs to know what's going on outside because it's affecting him. You know, he needs to know that people are breaking in. So he's going to be listening to the radio. If you listen just to the radio transmissions, because that's what just the officers can hear, it seemed like the world was coming to an end. And now you're standing in a hallway and somebody is, and this wasn't actually Babbitt who did this. I forgot the guy's name. Mm-hmm. It was the guy who took the helmet and started breaking the window. So now you've already seen, you know, you've heard the radio, officers screaming, begging for help. You don't hear your commanders anymore. I mean, at one point I thought Pittman took the launch codes and left. You know, so, you know, yeah. So, I mean, you don't hear command. You think it's over. So now he's in that hallway. And now the lobby door to the House floor of the United States House of Representatives is being cracked open. Right. And now, you know, that's when she jumped in. And then what he did, now he was in an unwinnable situation. His life was over when they made it to that door. His life will be forever changed. This will never leave him. You know, so I feel sorry. Like, I lost, you know, a lot of money and I lost, my career was over. You know, he's still working. He still has his career. But I wouldn't want to be in his shoes. He's probably going to get threats for the rest of his life. Be called a murderer for the rest of his life. So he's going to get that. But he was right where he was at. Like I said, it was over for him. Just because those people made it there at that particular moment, because she comes in, we know he shot, you know, and forever he's going to have to go with what he's going through. Had he not shot, and, you know, Ashley Babbitt, yes, I know she was a small woman. She came in. The question is, what other people had came in after her? And if you look on the other side of the floor, the members were evacuating on the other side. That door was open. People were leaving that door. If any member of Congress would have gotten hurt, Yogananda Pittman would have crucified him.
Yeah.
You know, she would have crucified him. So he would, whether he did or didn't, it was over for him.
Yeah. Damned if I do, damned if I don't. Now,
damned if I do, damned if I don't.
Let me ask you this, because this is a crucial part of what I have been trying to develop in my own series on the Capitol Police. I've only written 1, 2, and 3 parts so far. I have a fourth part. It is sketched out. I have been told by multiple people with whom I consult with in my life not to write part 4. Part 4 is the story of Byrd and Babbitt. Okay.
Yes.
And I don't feel that I can complete that without a direct response from Michael Byrd himself. And all full disclosure to those that are listening or watching is I did reach out to you and ask you to see if Byrd would give me an interview. Obviously, he said no. And that reason for him saying no is because he has a civil lawsuit coming against him from the Babbitt family. And obviously, his attorneys do not want him to speak. But let's talk about for a second. We don't have to spend a lot of time on this, but I really want the people that are interested in all things related to January 6th on both sides. I don't care if you're the sedition hunters and all you want to do is jack up everybody that was on the property that day. I don't care if you're so far on the other side that you believe that every single person that committed violence against law enforcement officers that day were doing the work of God. And believe me, I've interviewed people on that side. Okay. It's pretty, you know, there's extremes on both ends. I've been very fair, I think, in my stories about the Capitol Police that day. And one of the things that I'm hoping that someday I can convey it in a really knowledgeable way is the story of Michael Byrd and Ashley Babbitt in that moment. Because one of the things people do not understand is use of force protocols as it relates to you guys differently from other police agencies, maybe. And one of those is, I have learned from you as well as other officers, that deadly use of force is prohibited for damaging property, for instance. So when we see those officers inside the building on that west side, when that first window was breached and the two before came through and then the glass came popping out and the first two guys jumped through that window, one of the officers did a couple of squirts from a pepper spray canister and then they ran. I'm thinking to myself, this is me as a layman. I don't have a background in law enforcement, but I'm thinking to myself, my Lord, this is supposed to be one of the most secure buildings in the world. Why did they not draw their weapons and take out those first couple of people? And then none of this ever happens. You told me property damage is not in your, you're not allowed to do that or use deadly force in the event of property damage. Do I have that correct?
Well, close. You can't use deadly force unless you believe that serious death or serious bodily injury is about to occur. That's the only
time. To yourself or a member of
your... Or other people, yes. That's the only time you're authorized to use the force. It has to be, you have to feel your life is in danger to be taken or serious bodily injury. That's it. And the use of force, for the most part, it's the same for most... if not all law enforcement agencies.
Yeah.
It's the same. Even the White House. I don't know if you can just shoot somebody because they hopped the White House fence. I think people do that. You know, so I don't think that, no. So somebody can fact check me, but I've never heard of a law enforcement agency in the United States where if you cross a line, they're going to shoot you. No, I never heard that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the Marines guarding an embassy in a foreign land will shoot you if you try to bust through.
Yeah, I'm talking United States.
And then obviously I think because I have discussed with a retired Secret Service officer this particular situation, who actually for a couple of years was assigned as one of the special agents there at the Capitol. And he told me that if he had been standing at that window, he would have dropped them both. Before they ever got through the window, because he said that was their training. But the other thing, and this is where I want to go with this particular part of the conversation, is with you having laid that out in Michael Byrd's Ashley Babbitt situation, I think, or from what I can tell and what I've heard and what I've seen in other video angles, there were in fact lawmakers, Congress members at the end of that hallway. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay. Because that was the case, was that in fact a justifiable shooting based on your rules of engagement and your use of force protocols?
When it comes to justifiable, like that's not a question that I can answer because I would have to see all the facts. I would have to hear all the statements of people that were there. I would need to know everything, and there's no way I can know everything unless I looked at all the information that the DOJ had, and I did not. I didn't look at any of it because it's not my job. So what I always say is he should have never been put in that situation. He would not have been put in that situation had Yogananda Pittman passed down the intel that she needed to pass down to the people. That's one instance that he wouldn't have been put in that situation. Number two, he would not have been put in that situation if she would have evacuated the Senate chambers and the House chambers at the same time when I asked her to. There were multiple opportunities, but both of those opportunities were Yogananda Pittman. So, and she will not take any responsibility, because if you take any responsibility to say that, so she's going to keep saying that we didn't have enough intel, the intel that we had, I wouldn't have changed my posture. She has to say that, because if she doesn't say that, then that means she has to take responsibility for Ashley Babbitt being killed, Brian Sicknick being killed, Roseanne Boylan, everybody that died that day. She's going to have to take responsibility for all those deaths, and she's not going to do that.
On one side, as we talked about, the two, incredible extremes of this divisive January 6th story, mm-hmm. You have on the one side forever, as you mentioned earlier, Michael Byrd will forever be a cold-blooded murderer. On the other side, you have people that believe that the Capitol Police and the Metro Police should have made 1,000 other Ashley Babbitts happen that day. And again, I've heard both of those statements, and that probably will never change from people with those extreme positions. And it's one of the reasons why I've so desperately wanted to really dig into and tell the tragedy of this situation, which I think was just a moment. This is me, and I'm being honest before I'm going to offend people on both sides right now. I think it was a moment in time where just confusion, chaos, the fog of what was happening. Like you said, if you were listening to the radio comms at all, you thought the world was coming to an end. And I've heard them. I've heard those radio comms. It just converged in a moment of absolute tragedy. And we're all sorry that it happened. But nevertheless, Michael's got to deal with what he's got to deal with. And the family is dealing what they are dealing with. They're launching and filing a lawsuit against him. And then, which brings me transition to another hard question for you. Your life has been not destroyed. You're healthy. You got a great family. You've got a lot to look forward to in life. You're still young enough to rebuild in multiple ways. And I know you have designs on new career paths in the future, the near future, probably. But the question remains, you've had a tremendous amount of financial devastation and disruption to your life as a result of this, and as a result of your suspension, and then ultimately you leaving the department because you did not want to work with Yogananda Pittman any longer or work for her. Where are you on the idea of suing the department and suing Yogananda Pittman herself? I mean, certainly she's got some deep pockets now. They're growing every day with, you know, double income from UC Berkeley and Capitol Police. And have you thought about that?
I'm at a level 10 on that. I'm working on it right as we speak.
Level 10 meaning yes. This is going to happen.
As long as my attorney says that he sees everything in the best way to go, then absolutely. And that's one of the other things that I want to bring home to the people who are listening when it comes to what occurred on January 6th. Everybody on the ground that day, we're all J6s. We were all put in this situation by the exact same person. And that was Yogananda Pittman. Now, there's a lot of issues when it comes to, you know, this person committed excessive force. This person hit an officer. Like I said, we're all J6ers. And it's my opinion that what has to happen is this. We have to call a truce, because if you have the demonstrators attacking, like not physically attacking, just like on Twitter and calling people murderers and saying that, you know, you use too much force, you are, you know, you should be in jail. And then we're going to snap back. So we're still fighting. Yogananda Pittman needs us to fight. She needs us to be separated. She doesn't need us to come together. I promise you, she loves it whenever there's another video shown. This officer did this. He shot this and into the crowd, because it distracts from her failures on January the 6th. So at some point, we have to say, you know what? Let's call a truce right now and let's deal with Yogananda Pittman first. And then if we feel like we need to pick up, because the videos are going to be, they're not going anywhere. The fact that this happened or that happened is not going to change. You can just stand down on it and wait and deal with Yogananda Pittman. Because once you find out everything she did that day, because everything she did leading up to, on and after January 6th should be well documented. So everybody should know all the people that she destroyed after January 6th, the people's lives she affected on January 6th, and the actions that she did or didn't take before January 6th, that should be known to everybody. There are a lot of people out there who don't even know who she is. And she is the center. She is, and I've said this on Twitter multiple times, she is the alpha and omega of what occurred on January 6th. If you don't get to her to have her answer for what she did, there are things that could be lost. So we need to focus on Yogananda Pittman, because she was the one that put everybody in the situation. And when I say who are the J6ers, the police are the J6ers. The demonstrators were the J6ers. People have families. My wife and my daughter, who were not there on January 6th, they're J6ers. The people who are in jail, their family members are hurting, some financially, because of what Yogananda Pittman did to all of us. So at the very least, we can always pick up and discuss, because I even have an idea of what we can do for the when it comes to the excessive force stuff. And I would love to document that one day and outline it. But at the end of the day, we are all J6s, and Yogananda Pittman is one of the most powerful people in this country. And like I said on my other interview, people just don't know it. People didn't know. And like I said, Mark Cuban, nobody knew who he was until he bought the Dallas Mavericks, but he was rich the day before he bought the Dallas Mavericks. Mm-hmm. Yogananda Pittman was powerful before and on, like before J6. She was powerful before that day. people just didn't know. You didn't know who she was. And let me ask you a question. Before January 6th, did you know who Yogananda Pittman was?
No, not at all.
Absolutely no idea. Now, we at the Capitol Police, we know she's powerful. Even when I was on the radio, I was angry at her. And if you listen to all my radio transmissions that day, I made smart comments on the radio a lot because I was angry at her for not helping us. And I could not understand. You have your people begging for help. I begged. I probably begged maybe 10, 15 times that day. And she wouldn't help me. And I was angry. So I made a couple of smart comments. Even on the East Front, when things calmed down, I made smart comments because I was angry that she wasn't helping us. But I didn't want to go out there and directly embarrass Yogananda Pittman because that is a career killer. And it didn't matter because that's what happened to me anyway, because I did enough to embarrass her. My career was over probably at 228 when I evacuated the Senate. I just didn't know it.
Well, TK, I want to tell you how much I appreciate you spending this time with me today. And I'm not going to delve into any other specifics or circumstances that happened. I've said it before. Many of us have said this. You were responsible for some of the most heroic actions that took place that day. And you're completely, totally, 100% undeserving of what happened to you as a result of other incidences that you were involved in, whether it was the helmets, whether it was working with two Oath Keepers, whether it was wearing the MAGA hat. And even though your disciplinary report said that you were suspended for, quote unquote, conduct unbecoming, we know that that's not true. We know that that was a diversion from the reality. We've written about it. So I'm going to encourage everybody to look at the links wherever this podcast is posted. But more importantly, at this point, I know that you're in the fight for this truth to get out, particularly about Yogananda Pittman, and that this is going to be a long struggle. It's going to cost you a lot of money, particularly in legal bills and otherwise. And you've got a new Give, Send, Go. I'm going to have all the links to everything for those of you who are not familiar with Tarek's story and you're not familiar with the details related to Yogananda Pittman. Myself, Joe Heinemann from Epoch Times and others have written a tremendous amount about this. There's ample information for you to get up to speed on this. But more importantly, as I said, TK lost not everything. He still got his family, still got his house, but he lost his career. He lost his income. He's operating on a fraction of the income that he had right now. I know that as a friend, I can tell you that personally. I don't think he minds me telling you that. But in order for him to stay in this fight and to get this truth known to the American people, then he definitely needs help. So go help him. If you can help him with $5, $25, or $5,000, drop something in there so that he can continue this fight. And you know, buddy, I'm going to continue this fight with you as we move forward to get this truth out there.
And I say this regardless, I'm morally connected to this. And for me, my career, I could have stayed at the Capitol Police and I would have gotten my retirement in 17 months. But knowing what I knew at the time, I wouldn't have been able to look at myself just to get a pension to stay and be quiet, because I would have had to be quiet for another 17 months. When I came back, I would have had 17 months to go. I could have retired. I could have retired in March of 2024, but it was time, because everybody who was hurt on January 6th, it's time for justice, and the American people need to know the truth about what occurred on that day.
TK, thank you for coming forward. Thank you for being a truthful and honest whistleblower. Thank you for your heroism and bravery that day. And thank you for being my friend.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it very much, and take care. We'll talk later.